and welcome to Open the Pod Bay Doors. It is your regular deep dive into the Australian and occasionally Kiwi startup ecosystem. I'm your host today, Ian Gardner. Together with Faden Stow, we are behind Innovation Bay, which is a community group for startup founders and those that love startups. So check it out at innovationbay.com. I'm also a partner at Gelix Ventures, so check that out at gelix.vc. A little bit more about Innovation Bay. We've been around since 2003. We provide education and supporting events for startup founders and that whole ecosystem, active across Australia. So if you're interested and you haven't seen what we're doing, then yeah, just jump on the website, innovationbay.com. You can sign up to get the newsletter. And there'll hopefully be an event or some activity that you can get involved with in your local area. If you love this podcast, which I hope you do, then you know, leave us a review, tell other people about it on social media, and if you're really keen, yeah, just jump in the App Store, the Apple App Store, and leave a review there. That's super helpful for us, and yeah, really appreciate that. We couldn't do this podcast or Innovation Bay without our fabulous sponsors. So we got KPMG's High Growth Ventures team, AWS and Macquarie. So I'm sure you've heard of all of them. Check them out, use their services. They are massive supporters of the ecosystem. And yeah, we really appreciate their help. So today, it's part of funding month, you know, so we're breaking down the month into, or the year into different topics. So February is all about funding. Delighted to have been joined with by Rick Baker. So Rick was one of the founding partners at Blackbird Ventures. Previous to that, he was at MLC, so came out the sort of wealth management background. A terrific guy. We go into a lot of the background of Blackbird, but you know, I really particularly wanted to talk to Rick because of the astonishing outcome with Blackbird's Fund 1. So back in 2013, Blackbird raised $30 million from, I think Rick says, 97 individuals or individual investors, which, you know, nowadays is not a massive fund, but back then was a big one. They made some spectacular investments. You may have heard of these, so Canva, Safety Culture, Culture Amp, Zooks, Propeller, the list goes on. So the fund has been astonishing performance. I think on paper it's sitting at 13 times the capital invested. And late last year, late 2019, they did a deal to take new investment of $100 million, which came back into the business and was distributed to the LPs in cash. But the LPs still own 60% of the fund. So an amazing outcome, returning almost four times cash in that sort of seven-ish year period, whilst retaining 60% of the fund for you know, future growth. So really wanted to get into that story, which we do. So fantastic, and it's a great story. We also talk about New Zealand, what Blackbird's focused on, what's coming next, and a bunch of other stuff. So hope you enjoy it. I loved it. Really love Rick. He's a great guy. So here is my podcast with Rick. I am here with Rick Baker at the Blackbird's very fancy new office in Surry Hills. So thanks for having us, Rick, and thanks for being on the show.
Pleasure. Great to be here.
You're actually the third, it's the first time ever, but you're the third partner from Blackbird to be on the show. So three out of 70 is a relatively high percentage. So now I know a couple of things. One, the number of listens that both Nikki and Sam got on their shows, and two, just how competitive VCs are. So let's make this really good, so right, you can beat them in, on those things. So look, for those that don't know, and I'm sure they do, Blackbird is one of the original gangsters in the VC space. Launched, I think, 2013 it was?
2013. We started the firm 2012 and raised our first fund in 2013.
Yeah. And look, and that really is, I mean, there was some news at the end of last year that I probably want to just start, you know, start this with. And that was really the key reason I wanted you on. I mean, this is part of fundraising month and, you know, it's such good news. So do you want to tell us about Fund One and what's happened in the last few months?
Yeah. So it might be worth starting with the story of the beginning of Fund One, which was back in, as I said, we founded Blackbird in 2012. We started raising our fund and we set up all the legal entities for that fund and called it Blackbird 2012. And the embarrassing thing was we didn't quite get it closed in 2012. It ran into 2013 before we managed to rally together enough investors to actually start the fund. It was a long, hard fundraise. It was Nikki and me out, you know, meeting anyone who would talk to us. We had about 530 meetings to get our 97 investors, or limited partners as they're called, into that fund. It's a small $29 million fund. So long, hard fundraise.
Just as a side note, by the way, Nikki did talk to me, and it's my big regret. I mean, we'll get on to what happened. I didn't have any cash at the time, so I could have been part of it. But
we have a few people who have told us that. And it was one of the first sort of VC funds to be raised after, you know, really the taps had been turned off to Aussie VC. And, you know, we'll be eternally grateful to those 97 mainly individuals, and all of them except for one were just individuals, and most of them are tech founders who, you know, trusted us, gave us a little bit of money to give this a shot. So the fund has turned out really well. You know, it's invested in 20 companies. You know, as you know, venture's a power law game, and the great thing about Fund One is it's got a bunch of great companies. So it's got Canva in there, where we are the biggest investor shareholder by a long way. We own a big chunk of Canva, which is great. Safety Culture, Culture Amp, Propeller, the list goes on in that Zooks. Fund. Zooks, of course. So it's turned out to be a really, really great fund with not just one or two great companies, as you see in a lot of good VC funds, but it's actually got four or five great companies in that portfolio. And then another five or six that are actually also really good companies, but you know, a little bit dwarfed by the stars of the top ones.
Yeah. So, I mean, what happened? I mean, like, so normally with a fund, you've got a 10-year horizon, and towards the end of that 10 years, the companies, you know, either want to or get pushed to do an IPO or a transaction. But the market's changed over the last few years, and you've sort of piggybacked on that. So, I mean, do you want to dig into the way you were thinking and what you've done?
Yeah, so that fund, you know, it's just before we did this secondary transaction, which we've just done, the fund, the value of those, of the investments we'd made was about 13 times the money that we'd put in.
Yeah.
So it was doing really, really well. And
those, by the way, like, just a sort of inside baseball note, I mean, like, you value those transactions on other people's or subsequent rounds investments. So it's not,
that's right.
You know, you make up the valuation based on what you think it could be.
Yeah.
These are externally validated transactions.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And we won't write something up if we have priced the next round. Yeah. We're looking for external validation of those. But it's all paper valuations, right? Until you turn it into actual cash and then give that cash back to investors. So we got to that sort of 13 times in, you know, investment cost for that fund. And we're going into, you know, year eight of a 10-year fund. So you start to think about starting to sell down the you know, some of the holdings. And what we really didn't want to do was go to companies like Canva and Safety Culture and Culture Amp and say, hey, founders, you know, our fund's coming towards the end of its life. Can you please think about selling your company or IPOing your company?
Yeah.
Because in all of those cases, the companies are not ready. They're still growing incredibly fast. We still want to be holding those companies. And so the question was, how could we get liquidity for our investors and turn some of these paper returns into cash returns, but do it in a way that continued to follow and support these companies for the long term, and didn't get to a situation where we were trying to pressure them to sell or you know, exit in some way before they were ready to do so. And so we started looking around and thinking about the market, and started to see this sort of transaction, which is called a GP secondary strip sale. And, you know, it's been done a few times overseas, becoming a little more popular in the US with VC firms like NEA recently did quite a big version of one of these. And we thought we could do this for our fund. So what we did was sold a strip of the portfolio, so it's the same percentage in every company, to new investors. And actually, you know, one of the great things about about this sort of transaction is that the entity that buys that these shares is actually an entity that's a new fund that's managed by Blackbird. So really what we're doing is fundraising for a new fund, getting new investors in. Those investors set the price, so it's an arm's length transaction. And then we sell across to that new fund. We continue managing that fund. So from the founder or portfolio company's point of view, nothing really changes. It's just Blackbird transferring a portion of our shares from one Blackbird entity to another Blackbird entity, which means, you know, for the likes of these great companies like Canva and Safety Culture and Cultureamp and Zooks, you know, we're not selling down. We're just transferring our ownership and then being able to give back capital. So we've now given it back 3.5 times the capital invested in that fund to our investors, and they've still got about 6 times their money sitting in the ground growing with those companies. So pretty good kind of outcome.
So it was about 100 mil, I think, was the announced
100 mil Aussie
number.
Yep.
So that came in to the fund and you distributed that to the LPs?
To the LPs, yep. And which is pretty good for a $29 million
yeah,
fund.
And you still got, 60%+ or thereabouts?
60% exactly sitting in the ground growing.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of our investors have said we do get some extensions for after that 10 years. You can, with approval, get extensions. And, you know, a lot of our investors have said, well, this is great. Now we can happily give you guys those extensions and rest of it run, right?
It takes the voice off. I mean, there should be no pressure from them to do that. So,
And
that is astonishing performance by any metric. I mean, even just, you know, being on paper 15 times capital invested. I mean, that is just, I mean, can you give us an idea as to how far in the top, what percent of global funds this is fund one is performing?
It's hard for me to know, but I think it's, you know, it's probably one of the best VC funds in the world for its kind of age around at the moment, which is great. And what's particularly, I mean, obviously we're super chuffed about it here at Blackbird, but also great to prove that you can produce those sort of returns from a venture strategy in Australia. And, you know, from Australian startups. And that's something that's super exciting, I think, that, you know, we can create world-class venture capital returns here.
I mean, look, I think I speak on behalf of the entire ecosystem. I mean, first of all, congratulations. I mean, it really is astonishing. And secondly, it's great to see the validation. You know, we're out with Gelix trying to raise a fund just now, and it's nice to be able to point to some metrics around, well, look at what those guys did. And that's from the same sector and base that we're looking at. So, was there any pushback from the founders when you went to them with this? I mean, it doesn't sound like there should.
No, we haven't had any pushback. Obviously, we sat down with the, you know, our key holdings, but with all the founders in that portfolio, and everyone absolutely understood and I think, you know, understood that this is a way that takes pressure off them and means that, you know, they all understand that venture funds have, you know, these 10-year lives, and it's a, you know, it is a, it's something we get asked about by the most ambitious founders is, well, is 10 years long enough? And this sort of transaction allows us to say, well, you know, if it goes for longer than 10 years, but everyone's successful, then, you know, we have mechanisms for holding longer. And I think we'll see these sorts of transactions happening more and more. And you know, the one we did is specifically called a strip sale secondary, but there's also
it's called a strip
because you sell a strip of the portfolio.
Yep.
But there's a bunch of funds or very similar transactions that are called continuity transactions, and that's where you get toward to the end of your 10 or 12 year life of the fund, and a whole bunch of investors, say half the investors want their money back and half want to let it ride. You actually create these new vehicles where you allow people to choose whether they sell down or not, and you bring in fresh capital to cover those who sell down. So that's a different, sort of a slightly different take on this sort of secondary transaction. But I think we'll see things like that happening more and more in the market, and we'll certainly look at them, you know, as we get closer to the end of our fund life as well.
Innovation Bay is brought to you by our friends at Macquarie Group. Macquarie is a diversified financial group providing clients with asset management and finance, banking, advisory and risk and capital solutions across debt, equity and commodities, with offices in all major financial hubs across the world.
And is 10 to 12 years long enough?
I don't know. It's changing. I think about this quite a lot, and I think at the moment the venture capital industry is set around this 10 to 12 year time frame, and all the institutional investors, the super funds, the pension funds, they've all got this in their head as that's the right time. And so to change that is kind of a rock the boat type of situation. I would love to challenge that in the future, because I think it is, I think having longer timeframes is better. But there's also a certain there's something about that 10-year life frame, which means we do have to be thinking about the sorts of companies that can grow in value quickly, and that's an important part of venture, is can you grow fast? So it sort of sets that mindset. I think if we have these 10-year funds and then we have these options for continuity funds to extend the better companies, then that's a good thing.
I guess it'll depend too. I mean, an individual who's just turned 60 and is thinking about retirement is going to, they'll want the cash back probably in 10 years. Whereas a super fund like Host Plus, I mean, I know Sam Cecilia's talked about this, that he's the CIO at Host Plus. He doesn't want the money.
Yeah, they've got 20, 30 year time frames on their investments. Yeah.
His exactly. Membership are all like in their 30s on average. So does that mean that for the earlier funds that need that longer horizon, they're going to need more institutional funding rather than individuals?
I don't know. I think ideally yes, but what you tend to find is sort of young. You tend to start off with individuals, and then the super funds and the institutions come in a little later.
Yeah. Thinking about the transaction, I mean, it sounds complicated, and I'm sure, I think it was Alex was your sort of architect. So
Alex. Oh, Alex is our COO and partner now at Blackbird as well.
Right. Is that Alex male or Alex female?
Alex Apoifis, male. Alex.
Okay, gotcha.
Yes.
I think I know Alex. I just wanted to check. So, I mean, what's Alex's role? And I mean, what was the process like to actually execute this transaction?
Yeah. So we started by appointing an investment banker to help us.
Was that hard?
Well, look, it wasn't too hard. We gathered recommendations from people, and we interviewed five of them, got down to two, and then chose Lazard in the end.
Naive presence here as well in Australia.
No, they're not in not their secondaries team. They ran it out of Singapore.
Interesting.
Naively at first, I thought, oh, this is just a sale transaction. This is what we do. We can run this transaction. and that turned out to be a very naive thought, because firstly, it was really important for us to prove to our investors that we were running a full auction and getting an arm's length price on this, particularly since the fund vehicle that was going to receive these shares and therefore pay the money and set the price was going to be managed by Blackbird. So we needed to make sure that we had an auction which had global sophisticated investors setting the price, so that we could go back to our own investors saying, hey, this is, you can feel comfortable that this is an arm's length, real market price. Secondly, the transaction, the amount of information and the process was very labor intensive and quite intense. And I think there's a real skill that Lazard brought to the table in terms of identifying who were the potential bidders, and then going and contacting them, getting them excited, and then sort of following up and getting bids on the table from the bidders.
And from concept, you and the rest of the partners sitting around thinking this is a good idea, to cash in bank, how long did it take?
It was the best part of a year, probably 10 months from when we really kind of started to get going. I did a bunch of reference calls with some of the people who had done this before. On Lazard, and was asking them about the process, and they all told me that you think that the period of gathering all the information and then talking to all the bidders and getting to a final bidder is the tough part, but actually that's when the work starts, and it's the actual closing of the transaction that is complex. And for us, we had to go to each company and do the transfer docs. We had to get all the documents set up for a new fund. We had both international and Australian investors. We almost got caught up in FIRB, the Foreign Investment Review Board here, which we managed to change around the investor mix, so we didn't get caught up in that. There were a whole lot of complications. Tax was complicated too. So it was a labor-intensive transaction.
Yeah. Again, fantastic. Congrats. I mean, it's great for the sector, and you know, hopefully there'll be a bunch of new LPs, but LPs kicking around there with more cash in their pocket, and you know,
yeah, I hope so.
Keep investing in this sector.
Yeah.
So this is not a standard exit. I mean, maybe I just want to ask you about the whole IPO and M&A market. I mean,
yeah.
For a more, I'm sure within your 20, like there'll be some of are not there anymore, but yep. You know, there'll be a batch that will be coming up for some kind of traditional, using quote marks, exit in the next few years. So
yeah.
What's the market looking like for exits in your view at the moment? And you know, what is the most likely path for them?
Yeah. So every company, the plan A is to be a large standalone IPO company. And, you know, I guess a little unfortunately for the very best, the dream is to list on the US exchanges still. And you know, really be the next Atlassian. That's what everyone wants to be. So I think for the top two or three companies in our portfolio, that's absolutely still the plan. It's a few years out still before they want to IPO. I think a few of them could IPO right now if they really, really wanted to. But you know, as you know, the trend amongst founders has been to stay private longer, and I certainly know all the founders in our portfolio are sort of, I think rightfully sort of holding back a bit and saying they'd like to IPO later at a more mature stage rather than sort of push it and IPO early.
Yeah, I don't often meet founders who've IPO'd that say, that was amazing. I loved the process and being listed is the best thing ever.
And I wish I listed 3 years earlier or something. Yeah.
You know, it's hard.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
I mean, do you want to touch on the difference between, I mean, you talked about, you know, Atlassians and, you know, maybe Canvas and, you know, the big, the big companies who may go to the US, but there's also a trend. I mean, it feels like the compliance and overhead burden of listing is a little easier in Australia. I mean, do you want to touch on the difference between that and what you're seeing?
Yeah, look, I still think that, and I do say a little unfortunately, because I'd love to see the ASX opening up to our best companies, but there is unfortunately still a desire to go to the US. But I think there is a real opportunity for businesses, particularly SaaS businesses here. I'd love to see some really clean, recurring revenue SaaS businesses hit the ASX.
Yeah.
I feel, you know, there's some great businesses, tech businesses and software businesses on the ASX, but we haven't got many just sort of pure SaaS growing month on month kind of, you know, mini Atlassians.
Yeah, like a SiteMinder or an Aconex.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, I think Aconex was probably the best example before it was taken off the exchange of just growing nicely with strong SaaS metrics. And I'd love to see a cohort of those companies come onto the ASX, you know, with sort of 50 to 100 mil ARR kind of would be perfect to see. So I hope within our portfolio we see a few companies able to do that.
Yeah.
In terms of M&A from around the world, you know, I think it's as strong as it ever was. I think the challenge for Australian companies is that we haven't seen many Australian acquirers, but since the media companies have kind of stopped doing that.
Yeah.
And so the challenge is that it's mainly offshore and, let's say, you know, mainly US companies that are doing sizable acquisitions, and the need, you know, that there is a, it is more difficult for a US company to buy a team that where most of the team is in Australia. So they just struggle to
It's true, actually. Aren't any of the big Aussies. I mean, even the banks. I mean, you'd have thought the four banks with their 30% of the ASX capitalization should be snapping up a few startups, but not.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, Telstra's not really doing anything anymore. And then there was the media, right? It was a media company. It was Fairfax News and et cetera, who were snapping things up, and they've all stopped acquiring.
Trying to manage decline rather than growth.
Yeah. So you know, I'd love to see some real acquirers step up in the market here as well, but I'm not quite sure who it is.
Yeah. We should talk about just Blackbird and its general philosophy. I mean, it's, I mean, I often think, you know, I know most of the VCs and a lot of them have been in the show and I kind of know them quite well. And, you know, Blackbird's got a different view, I think, to the others. I mean, it's quite contrarian. You've done some weird shit, if I can put it that way. So, you know, I remember when Nikki first told me about Zooks, I'm like, what? You know, and there's been some other stuff you've done. So, I mean, do you want to touch on your investment thesis and philosophy, what you're looking for, and, you know, why it's a bit different to the others out there?
Yeah. So, so I'd start by saying, you know, one of the things we kind of believe is that the next really big success is not necessarily going to look like the last one. And so we spend a lot of time thinking about pattern matching and how you look for the factors that drive success in a startup, particularly when it's super early at sort of seed or early Series A stage. But we're constantly challenging ourselves and we're kind of paranoid about just investing in the same thing that we know well. It's so easy to get caught in the trap of you make a few good investments in a certain area and then you get confident in that area and then your investors say, well, just invest in that area. Don't go and try new things. And history has shown that when that's happened and people just invest in the same thing over and over again, they tend to go over the cliff with that particular style of or area of investing. So we're constantly trying to challenge ourselves for new things. So right now our sort of strategy is about half of our investments are made in classic software, internet, marketplaces, things like that. Everything we invest in has to be this sort of idea of big global markets.
I think you've got an expression,
big
global,
ambition.
Global from day one.
Yeah, global from day one, global from the outset. And, you know, it's about being not the best in Australia but the best in the world. And that's really, really important for us. And we're about big swing for the fences, big ambition missions, and we're happy to take a lot of risk around big ambitions. As long as we can see a reasonable path or we can imagine how this company would achieve its visions and then become hugely valuable. So half is software, classic software, internet, SaaS. We love SaaS. We particularly love SaaS sold in a bottom-up way, Canva, Safety Culture being the two best examples in our portfolio so far of that. And then the other half of our investing is in really crazy stuff. So We really want to push the boat out here. We want to look for the next investment themes. So we've been investing in, as you said, in autonomous vehicles very early. When we invested in Zooks, it was really only Google that was doing autonomous stuff. And, you know, obviously since then that whole area has blossomed and attracted a lot of investment. We got in early into alternative proteins, so both plant-based proteins and lab-grown meat. Continue to invest in that space. We really like.
Just before you go on, I mean, like on the meat alternatives, if that's the right expression. Like, I mean, what stage are those businesses at? Are they in market? Like, can you go out and buy the non meat burgers nowadays?
So we've made four investments in the space. Two are in market. Two are not. The two that are in market are SunFed, the chickenless chicken. Business. It's a New Zealand company. Great product. Listeners should try it. It's in Coles in Australia. And then a little newer, but just out in the market, is Fable, which is a mushroom based pork product or substitute pork product. Again, awesome product. And that's a company that. Is founded amongst others by Michael Fox, who's as you know, she's a Prey founder, and a really good friend of Blackbird. So we're very keen to follow him and back him in his next business.
Support for Innovation Bay and Open the Pod Bay Doors comes from our global partner, High Growth Ventures, KPMG's dedicated startup team who work with founders, providing them with the tools and insights required for sustained high performance.
Sorry, I interrupted. You were just talking about the other sectors that you're going.
Other sectors, other things we kind of like. So we've invested in space, both a rocket company and a microsatellite company.
So that's Gilmore and Fleet.
Gilmore and Fleet, yep. LIDARs, Baraha, which is a great
that's
company.
A cool business.
Yeah, really, really awesome LIDAR product. And then in the AI space, we particularly like the crossover between sort of healthcare, diagnostics and AI. We've made three investments in that space. We'll continue to make more. I think we think that the way that healthcare services are delivered, particularly diagnostic healthcare services delivered over the next 10 to 20 years will change dramatically and turn a lot from very human subjective things to far more sort of machine-based procedures. So very interested in that space. And we will continue to invest in brand new things and things that seem crazy at the beginning. We've got this saying, science nonfiction, which is that it looks crazy, looks like science fiction when you first hear about it, but when you lift up the hood, the sort of march of technology means that this thing is eminently doable and eminently doable, importantly for us, within the sort of amount of funding that we can provide.
Yeah. So let me ask a slightly different question. I mean, it's astonishing the range of these crazy, if that's the right expression, investments that you're making, but how do you as a business and maybe even you as, you know, Rick Baker and Nikki and all and Sam and all the rest of it, how do you keep up to date and how do you learn about these new sectors? And because, you know, it's so busy. I mean, like your job is just insane.
Yeah.
You're trying to do everything. How do you find time to keep learning?
Yeah. So look, I'd say it starts with this filtering mechanism where we're looking for certain attributes in the type of business. And it starts with the founders and these really ambitious founders who can really articulate their mission well and then convince us that their mission is achievable. So it really does start with the people involved. And then I'd say there's these kind of rivers of inquiry that we go down. And it's funny, sort of investments, the best way to learn about investments is to start making some small seed investments in a space. And, you know, the only free lunch in venture capital is that you can make these small seed 100K, 200K investments, see what happens, learn about the space. And out of a $100 million fund, you can take super high risk, both super high risk on the actual company and super high risk in sort of our understanding and building of a market. And in many cases, what we love is when we go into these new spaces, there's no real experts. When we invested in Zooks, there wasn't a driverless car industry. There weren't experts in driverless cars. And so we were able to sort of network around, pull the few people who were specialists in driverless cars at that stage, learn from them, talk to them, find the next person to talk to. And you can kind of come up the learning curve in those brand new areas and become an expert in those areas relatively quickly. Whereas if we were to invest in, I don't know, a mining company, right, there's this whole body of expertise in that area that it takes us a long time to kind of level up. And then we make small investments and we start learning, and then we get these rivers of inquiries. Like, you know, Zooks, we learned about the driverless car industry and that led us to the LiDAR industry. And we started with an investment in fleet, in satellites, but that was more around, it wasn't really that much to do with satellites. It was actually, we were really interested in the way that they could create a global network, low bandwidth network for Internet of Things. And it was really that drove our investment thesis more than the fact that it was done from space.
Yeah.
But once we'd done that, we started to then network into the space industries and understand the problems, and particularly the problems around getting things up to space and what were the drivers of that, and then found Gilmore Space. And I think what's particularly interesting about Gilmore Space is not just that it's a rocket launcher, but they actually have a new form of rocket engine that is a lot more reliable and more cost effective than standard liquid rocket engines. So
it's small. That's one of the things about that.
And,
yeah.
Yep. And small. And so really sort of that led us to Gilmore and then an understanding of that. So it's sort of these kind of rivers of inquiries and then making small bets and following on as we start to learn and as the companies get successful.
And is there any, like, I mean, we've had Bill Barty was on the show. I mean, again, he was one of the early partners at
absolutely.
Blackbird, but he's now with Main Sequence.
Yep.
You know, and a lot of this stuff is kind of in that, you know, slightly crazy territory that they're playing in. Are you stepping in each other's toes at all around this?
No, we've done a bunch of investments together. Obviously know Bill really well, so we really like investing with those guys.
Yeah. Yeah, and look, I mean, again, personally speaking, I mean, one of Gelix's philosophies is, you know, we want deep tech and, you know, non-traditional areas. And, you know, so we love what both you and Main Sequence are doing. So, so this is part, as I said at the start of the show, this is part of the funding month, you know, so we're trying to just keep the momentum in education for founders out there. It's pretty hard to get Blackbird to invest in you. I mean, I'm sure, I don't know what your ratios are, whether you talk about them between number of companies you look at or even take a bit of a deep dive on versus the ones you invest in, but my suspicion is it's one in 200 or something like that.
We see close to 1,000 companies a year.
Right.
And that's been kind of steady for the last couple of years. And we invest in eight.
Right.
Also eight to 10. So it's a...
One in 100.
Yeah.
So it's hard.
Yeah.
So the question is, what advice would you give founders out there who are listening to this and think, oh my God, I wish I could get an investment from Blackbird? You know, because you don't want your time wasted. You don't want to waste their time. Who are you looking for and how should they approach you?
Yep. So I'd start with this really big ambition. As I said before, you know, we are all about big ambition ideas. Firstly, I think you really need to think about whether venture capital is right, and then Blackbird is at the sort of upper ambition end of venture capital. So it has to be really a big global idea. And then I think key to it, really key, is this idea of articulating your vision really well. I'd say of almost all our founders, they walk in the room, they've got this really clear idea of what their product is, and most importantly, how their product fits into the world and fits into an industry or a group of people or a demographic, and starts to change the way they do things and how those people get real value out of that product. And it's that articulation which really gets us excited. And then the next step is how to sell and help sell that business or sell that product and get it into the hands of users quickly and efficiently. And again, we are less about models that need lots of door knocking, human sales teams, long sales cycles, big enterprise type sales. And we love models that where people find out about a product, they try it, they champion it within their organization, they put their corporate credit card in and they start paying lots of little amounts. And we love that sort of sales model as opposed to, say, an enterprise sales model. And something, because that sort of model can be done globally right from the beginning. So I'd say that's sort of really core. The overarching thing is to ramp ambition. I'd say the biggest feedback that I have to people who I meet who pitch things to me, and this is particularly, I think, happens in Australia, is the, you know, coaching them on this idea of ramping their ambition up. How can you 100 times that? You know, I think it's interesting that you're trying to sell this much. How can we 100 times it?
Yeah.
You know, I think it's interesting that you want to sell to this many people or do et cetera. We need to, you know, how can you 100 times that? Imagine that money was not an issue. What would you do? And that's the sort of thinking we need to tease out a bit more in Australia.
Yeah.
Open the Pod Bay Doors is made possible by our partners at KPMG High Growth Ventures and Macquarie Group.
Can we talk about the VC sector overall? I mean, it's since 2012, 2013 when you launched. I mean, it's night and day in terms of the number of funds. I mean, there must be 50 funds plus a huge amount more in the works.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
It is fantastic. Yeah, and, really, you know, and the point is that, you know, the founder pipeline is healthy. Yeah. You're seeing better educated, more sophisticated, smarter founders. It's easier to start a business, so you can get more rolls of the dice. In some ways, the risk has been reduced. So when is there too much money in the VC sector? I ask this with most of my VC guests, but and they all give a similar answer, so I'll be interested in yours.
Yeah. So firstly, I'll just start a little bit with why I'm excited about where we're at right now. And we've just hit it or we're just hitting it right now, this sort of tipping point where it's sort of becoming – you know, ambitious people are wanting to go into startups and start businesses, and people who are leaving, you know, finishing university kind of towards the top of their class are starting to think sort of less about going to work for this big corporate, which, as we all know, you know, used to be the thing to do, whether it be a bank or a management consultant, you know, or a big corporate or a big mining company, and are starting to think, you know, the most prestigious, ambitious, and wealth-generating thing they can do is go and work for a startup, or especially found a startup.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is super exciting. And the startup in ecosystem, which includes venture capital as just part of it, is becoming mature enough that people are feeling quite safe going into startups now. And this has been the case in Silicon Valley for a long time, that people have understood that if you go and work for a startup and for whatever reason it fails, there's 50 more startups that will highly value your experience.
Yeah.
And actually, a lot of these big corporates will highly, highly value your experience in a startup as well. I think we're just starting to see that start in Australia, and that's awesome. So how much money is too much in Australia? I don't think we're there yet. I think sort of the AIC, which is the industry body that kind of measures these things, it's been about a $1 billion, maybe a little more, $1.1 billion, $1.2 billion raise sort of the last 2 years. And a lot of people, and that's up from literally 100 mil a year, 7 or 8 years ago. And so a lot of people saying, oh, it's 10 times, well, it's going to be too much money, too much competition. Here's why I don't think that's the case. Firstly, so of that, so let's just call it $1 billion for round numbers. About half of that $1 billion is targeted at late stage companies.
Yep.
So it's things like we have a follow on fund, which is actually, you know, size wise the bulk of our capital. So do most of the other larger VCs in Australia. And so companies like, you know, Canva and Safety Culture and CultureAmp are raising $50-100 million licks of capital. And so if you take half of that $1 billion per year, you only need, 4 or 5 or 6 of these big rounds, and you've sucked up a lot of the capital in Australia. And the great thing now is that some of these later stage companies are happy to take in the later stage Aussie investors. And so we're getting to invest in those later stage companies. So that leaves about 500 mil in Aussie, really focused on early stage. And, if we compare that to the US, a standard early stage venture capital fund in the US is $300 or $400 million US, which is about 500 mil. So we have about, in the whole market for Australia, focused on seed and series A, we have about one, big VC fund in the US for our whole market.
Yeah.
So you got to think about it that way. And I think that if you think about it that way, you can understand that this is not that much money for an ecosystem that's really growing nicely and is raising. We're no longer, seed rounds are now $1 million to $2 million happily, and that's good. And series A's can be, $3 to $5 million. And so that capital gets sucked up pretty quickly.
Yeah. I think the other chart that I saw in that same AIC report was the relativity one, showing VC investment per head of population. And Australia's way down. I mean, we're like, within the developed countries, like not even in the top two thirds.
Yeah.
It's way, way down. We're under Austria and a few other places that you would not think of as startup capitals.
Yeah.
So I agree. I think.
And then the next thing I say when particularly it's usually sort of institutional investors who ask me this is I say, look, call up, I'll give you 10 founders, call them up and ask them how easy it is to raise capital in Australia. It's still not easy to raise capital in Australia. It's a lot easier than it was, which is fantastic. And I think now, we're kind of at a stage now that the good enough companies are, or most of them are, starting to get funded, but there's still a big filtering. When there's not money being splashed around here, particularly in my view.
We've talked about Australia a lot.
Yeah,
we've mentioned like one Kiwi company. So I want to talk about New Zealand because that's become a focus. So the other thing that was announced in the last, I think, first half of the last year was a fund, a $30 million fund dedicated to New Zealand. So can you touch on New Zealand and why you're excited about it?
Yeah. So we have just raised a $30 million fund to invest in New Zealand. And then two Blackbird people, Sam and Tip, have gone to set up our Auckland office. They're there right now. Just saw a...
Tip's a native, isn't she?
She's a native. Yeah, just seen a photo of their office. They have no furniture. They have about three chairs and a dining room table in there. But we're all set up. We're all over there. And, yeah, I think what we're seeing in New Zealand is just many of the same attributes as we see in Australia. We're seeing really good founders. We're seeing a lot of tech talent, and I guess I should say software engineering and hardware engineering talent in New Zealand. You know, places like Google here in Australia employ a whole stack of New Zealanders for their engineering teams. They're just sort of, you know, really sucking them over. And so there's lots of great talent in New Zealand. There's a similar thing happening in New Zealand as we saw happening in Australia, which is that you're getting some lighthouse companies like Rocket Lab, we're starting to see people understand that you can do really well inside startups. We're starting to see people come out of Rocket Lab and start their own companies. So it's this same sort of founder ecosystem, founders helping founders, happening in New Zealand as there was happening and is happening here. And the other great thing is that there's still almost no, New Zealand is still starved of venture capital.
Yeah.
You know, really the difference between in stage wise between Australia and New Zealand, you know, I think is just that New Zealand is at that same stage of having almost no venture capital in the ecosystem as we were a few years ago. And we think that'll change. And we want Blackbird to be sort of at the front of that and for our brand to be, you know, well known over there and to hopefully kind of be this magnetic force for the great founders over there. You know, that's our plan.
How's Sam and Tip doing? Have they got some good,
excellent
pipeline looking
good?
Yeah,
pipeline's looking really good. We have we just closed the fund actually, sort of towards the end of last year, and so hopefully we're working on the first investment. So hopefully we'll announce something in the next little while.
Yeah, and you even went as far. So you run Sunrise every year, which is your big conference. You know, you normally get 1,000+ people, and you know, I think you must have run 5 in Australia.
We've done 5 in Australia. That's right. Yeah. And the last one was at Cockatoo Island. It was a huge organizational project.
Yeah, I remember the seagulls.
The seagulls.
They really messed with my podcasting.
Yep, absolutely. Nearly very killed Joel, our head of community, who organizes a sunrise.
Yeah, he looked shell-shocked that day.
And you think every single chair, every single sandwich had to be barged into the place.
But you did it in New Zealand this year.
So we did it in New Zealand. And we wanted to take a deep breath. And we actually wanted to go a bit back to our roots of Sunrise, which is really founders telling their stories. And what was great about New Zealand is there are a bunch of sort of fresh people that we could tap to come and tell their stories. And it was a really fantastic event. It was a little smaller. We had about 500 people, but it really just great atmosphere there, lots of enthusiasm. Really, we were really excited about the event and particularly just that sort of community coming together you know, in New Zealand, which was great.
And are you going again this year or is that under wraps?
We will definitely be doing the Sunrise again this year. I won't steal Joel's thunder as to where it will be or what format it will be in. Watch this space.
We're getting close to the end here, so just a couple more questions. I mean, really, the future. I mean, like Blackbird's been going for 8 years or thereabouts.
Yep.
I mean, unbelievable result from Fund 1. You've already raised Fund 2 and 3.
Yep.
What's next?
Yep. Well, we'll raise Fund 4 this year. We're growing the team, which is great.
Yeah. How big is the team now? And who's
the team is now 19.
Wow.
Which is big for us. It was not that long ago that it was, you know, it was really just a few of us.
Yeah.
I think what we've really realized is that you know, there's a great opportunity here. We want to be a world class investment house, and to be a world class investment house, you have to have the right people. And we've really grown the ops side of our business. For anyone starting a venture fund, you know, investment is obviously central, but it is amazing how important the operational side of the business is, and it's becoming more and more
overhead.
Yeah,
we're just seeing it with Gelix now. So
Yeah.
Unfortunately,
yeah.
Andrea's a lawyer.
Excellent. Excellent. So we've really spent a lot of time building out that team.
You've got a full, it's a full-time legal counsel, full-time chief of staff.
Just hired a general counsel, Justine, which is fantastic to have her here.
Yeah.
Chief of staff we've just hired. Yeah. And the idea there is to really do what we see our portfolio company founders and CEOs doing, which is to look at the things you do every day and look at what things it is essential that you do and what someone else who's a senior person within the team could take and do. And so we've just hired Sophie, who's come on board, and it's fantastic to have her here. And I really feel this next year for Blackbird is all about us really leveling up and getting better at what we do.
Actually, maybe one last question. I might have one more after this. But you said Fund One had 20 investments. But I mean, overall in total, like how many are in the portfolio and how much capital have you deployed?
There are 65 companies in the portfolio. And how much capital have we deployed? I, off the top of my head, don't know the exact number. I'm not sure.
All right. I mean, it's got lots of zeros at the end of it. So, I never know whether this is a fair or unfair question, but government and policy around startups. Yeah. I'm just looking at you, trying to work out whether you want to answer this, but
I can answer it quickly.
Yeah. What do we think, and what can the government do better?
Yeah. So I would start by saying, in my view, it's not about handing out more money and providing more subsidies. I think the R&D
leadership.
Yeah, it's about leadership, exactly. I think what the things we have in place now are really great. The R&D tax credit is fantastic. The ESVCLP system is fantastic. The angel investment tax breaks are great. I don't really think we need anything more from that point of view. What we really, really need is leadership. We need politicians, and particularly our senior politicians, to understand that innovation will drive the success of Australia over the next couple of decades. And we need people to be cheerleaders and mature cheerleaders about why we need to innovate, how we innovate, and help the nation understand that this is not about trying to threaten people's jobs and take things away from people. It's about trying to build new jobs. It's about trying to take part in this thing that's happening all over the world. And if we don't take part, then our jobs will still be affected, but they'll be affected by big US companies, not by Australian companies. And that's far more difficult for us to deal with. But on the positive side, I kind of feel that the whole startup ecosystem, it kind of happens whether the government's kind of cheerleading or not. If it's going to happen, it'll happen.
Yeah.
And I think it's happening now, and I think, what's awesome is, in so many areas where, at least in my view, our politicians are letting us down, we're seeing the, corporates and private people and individuals and businesses stepping up and almost taking up the mantle and saying, we don't need the government to tell us to do this. We're going to start doing it. We're seeing that on the climate side, and in lots of other areas as well. And I think that's pretty awesome.
Hear, hear.
Yeah.
All right, Rick, we might call the formal part of the interview over.
All right.
Thank you. And congrats again on all the success. And look, thank you for being part of it and showing your courage and leadership when you did, because I'm sure when you were doing those 600 meetings with Nikki and Bill, it was not obvious.
It was not obvious at all. It still isn't obvious.
Yeah. It's never still easy. Work, if it was easy, it. Everyone would do it, and it's not
still
easy.
Still a startup.
Now, I threatened to hit you with quick-fire questions, seemed unhappy about. But
that's all right.
It's good for the listeners, because I know they do look at it. So can you give us your favorite book or recommended book?
All right. My favorite book is Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Okay. Do you want to expand on that?
Oh, I just think it's such a great story. It's written in a very interesting style where the narrator is kind of part of the story, but he's not the main character. I think it's just a really interesting book.
Awesome.
And I'm sick of giving tech and self-help books. As an
that's fair enough. Recommended podcast?
Yours.
Oh, thank you. Apart from this one.
I actually read more than listen. Okay. Certain members in our team listen more than read, but so I don't have a strong go-to.
And do you carve out time for reading? Is that just before bed or like in the morning or what?
I read at night, and then I try hard to do a bit of reading every morning.
Right.
And I don't achieve it every morning.
Productivity tool. How do you stay efficient?
Yeah, I've just started using Front to manage my email. And we've also, one of our new hires, shout out to Clark, is our head of productivity and is really trying to ramp up all the tools we use and make them super efficient. Front has meant that we can collaborate on email, and it's got lots of nice features like being able to comment on email, ways to archive things. I'm enjoying it. I'm only a week into using it, but
that's cool. I haven't actually heard of it. I mean, yeah. You heard it. Superhuman. That seems to be the cool one out there, but I don't know. That whole email conundrum. I think it was Ashik from Deputy. I don't know if you listened to that episode, but he was like, I've solved email. I've mastered email. And, you know, he just uses Gmail and all the tools in it and archive and snoozies. And, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's so easy. I'm trying very hard to, my sort of New Year's resolution is to try and stop my inbox ruling my life and move to a task manager to rule my life.
Yeah.
Because I set the priorities in the task manager.
I think that's a good tip.
We'll see if it works. But I'll try.
Do you have a favorite news source? What's your go-to?
Oh, look, local news, AFR, SMH, I read every morning. I think on sort of global and tech, I read the Pro Rata daily newsletter. I think that's really good for just keeping up with the quick what's happening in the world.
Who writes that?
Dan Premack.
He used to be like Venture or something, wasn't he?
He used to be at Fortune and now he's at Axios. Fortune.
That's right.
Yeah, which is a sort of startup. And then for deeper stuff, The Information is great. Yeah. That's paid. And, really good journalism there, and I think gets down.
Super interesting model. I mean, they have no sponsors or advertisers whatsoever, and they just pay their staff, and you can only get it if you subscribe. And it's not crazy expensive. It's like $400 US a year.
Yeah, it's good. So,
that's worth it. Do you have a favorite app on your phone? What's your go-to?
Well, I'm just starting to use Front on my phone.
A non-boring one.
Well, I do quite a bit of kiteboarding, so I spend a lot of time looking at the wind. So Sea Breeze is a go-to. It's probably one of the apps I look at the most.
And how often are you on your kiteboard?
Not often enough.
Twice a month, roughly.
Yeah, once or twice a month.
It's dependent on your availability and the conditions.
Yeah, it's not. When I first started doing it, I was trying to go weekly, but no, it's if I get out every month, I'm lucky.
Tough one for you because you've got so many, but who's your favorite CEO?
Yeah, I know. It's like saying, who's your favorite baby?
Yeah, I know.
Oh, look, I'm going to go for the obvious one, Melanie at Canva.
Yeah.
Fabulous CEO.
Yeah, I've heard that from many sources. She was, we had her booked for the end of year event with Innovation Bay, and unfortunately, she had a client meeting or something came up, and, it was meant to be her and Cliff, which was, we were like high fiving around the office. Shame. Yeah. I'm sure she'll be back. So, it's good to see her getting out there a little more now.
I think getting some excellent publicity. And it's really good.
Astonishing story. Love that story.
Yeah.
Time to watch TV. And if so, what do you watch?
Yeah. I am halfway through The Loudest Voice, which is the, it's not a documentary. It's just the show about
Stan.
It's about the start of Fox News. Russell Crowe as
Bulger.
A Els.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing story. Yeah.
That's an amazing
Andrew
story.
I was watching it and I tuned into a couple of episodes and it was.
Seems like amazing. A terrible man.
Yeah. He was not the best.
But just fascinating to watch.
Russell Crowe did a great job.
Yeah. Very excellent acting. And
the opposite of his role of Gladiator.
Yes. And just scarily fascinating to understand a little bit of the thinking of the American sort of conservative right.
Yeah. Yes. Last question. If Ted phoned you, you know, and asked you to do a talk on a specific topic, what would you talk about?
Yeah, I was thinking about this. I think I might choose the power of growing ambition and having a really strong vision that you can articulate well. I think as I sort of watch founders and even just watch people who are successful in life, this sort of ability to articulate something and really sort of picture it in your mind and then to convince other people that it's actually doable is this sort of really important skill set.
Yeah.
And, you know, it means that founders really with a really strong vision, they might sort of tick and tack underneath, but they've got this kind of like lighthouse to help them make decisions. And they've got to make hundreds of decisions a day. And if you've got this really strong lighthouse at the top, you're more likely to get, you know, the whatever, you know, percentage it is that you've got to get right.
Yeah.
When you make those decisions.
All right. Rick, thank you.
Pleasure.
It's fascinating. And congrats again. And keep up the good work.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Rick.